we move on to our deep dive, and we're deep diving into corporate structures and how they're affected by things like rights issues and other corporate actions. I suppose this is sparked by, in part, Pick and Pay and the recent developments that have taken place there. But we've also seen a couple of corporate changes in South Africa, CFOs and company executives resigning, and businesses unbundling, the likes of We Buy Cars unbundling from Transaction Capital. And most recently, the Nutton Credit business also now being announced that it will be sold off by the Transaction Capital guys. Corporate structures are so weird.
A lot of the time, they're not entirely planned.
Yes.
I think what happens is a company does really well, yes, and it buys something that it thinks does really well, and it buys something else that it thinks does really well. And before you have it, before you know, you've got a mixed match of, you know, a whole bunch of different businesses that you somehow now have to put into one package. And
yes. And I suppose with
and what Mary Roberts saw in Australia, their one business went bust, and unfortunately it held the business that was doing good. And they were like, yo, we want that one. And it's like, nope.
Yeah, so this, I suppose this is all, it stems from accounting, right? So the fact that you have to consolidate into one set of consolidated financial statements when you're dealing with subsidiaries, and that creates a complex nightmare to be able to do this. And then for some businesses, it's easier to just say, hey, keep your own separate financials. We'll keep our own because you are doing one way and we don't want those numbers on our balance sheet. And as you say this, I'm thinking about
Well, they've got to consolidate if it's above if you've got more than 50% of equity.
Yes.
You've got to then consolidate into your balance sheet. And
yes, but if you have a separately listed business that has its own sort of structure and everything.
So that simplifies it. I think what happens is if you have something like Transaction Capital, which was, it's quite a sad story really, because they were a couple of years ago, the darling.
Absolutely.
They were doing so fantastically well, right? And then, you know, nothing can go wrong until something goes wrong. And suddenly you have the situation where, you know, like Simon said earlier, one part of the business is doing poorly, but you are now, it's now affecting every other part, you know, which is.
But it comes back to, and I think so a lot of companies in the JSE are actually technically holding companies, in that there's a company at the center and then they've got all these little subsidiaries, which
I've got a favorite.
Of, you know, they own 95% of, and the other 5% is some shareholders or something. But you made an interesting point where you said they're often not planned, and I agree with that. But I think the flip side is oftentimes they are planned. Pick and Pay had the Pickwick Holdings, which had, you know, so the Ackerman family held a majority of Pickwick, which held a majority of Pick and Pay. So they effectively had 26%, but they had control of the business. So, and we saw with.
But that's kind of like building the plane while it's flying situation, right? That's. They didn't think that they would get as well. Maybe they
did.
No, but when they started, when did they list? You said 1960 something.
But I mean, go back to NASPAS. We trade. We trade the N shares because the A shares get 1,000 votes per one, as opposed to the N's.
Yeah.
And that was a way of protecting the what was then the Afrikaner Nationalism, National Party media empires.
Yeah.
So sometimes they are carefully planned, but then a lot of them, like, and you go, and it was, I think it's Remgro, which, like, no one knows they've got B shares. And the B shares give them control. Pick and Pay still has B shares. So, and weirdly, the sense talks around the B share has an A share stapled to it. I'm like, stapled? People have staplers? Anyway, so sometimes it is very carefully. Christo Visa.
I was just going to say.
The control structures, I mean, are probably then carefully planned. You know, I agree with that. But the companies that make up that group are sometimes the product of opportunistic, you know, moves over many, many, many decades.
Yeah.
So the company.
So Remgro.
So Remgro. Yes.
So Remgro. Yes.
So Remgro. Pick and Pay. We Buy Cars. NASPAS. Whatever. You buy. Let's back this little internet company. See what happens. Boom. It goes massive. All right. Let's do a bunch of delivery companies that'll never make money. so you know, whatever. Like, you have this mix of different, completely different, unrelated businesses somehow in the same pot. And the only thing that you really have power over, I guess, is the director level, owner level, is, well, how do we structure the shares so that we keep control of it?
Yeah.
But that, I think that's the other big thing there is, like Sai was mentioning about the B shares, is you often don't realize where control sits.
Yes.
And Pick and Pay is one such example we'll get into. But the other example is Christo Visa, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a meeting with him. I was privileged enough to sit down with the man and chat to him about a couple of things. But in doing so, I just had a look at the structure, right? So when you would read all these reports around people's net worth and all of that stuff, and he only holds probably about 10% of ShopRite at the moment in terms of shareholding. But there is a specific share or specific voting right associated with him as an individual, which is not transferable, which therefore means he wields control at the moment, significant control and influence over ShopRite through that voting right allocation.
It has no economic value.
He cannot transfer it to anyone else. But that kind of thinking around saying, I will water down my holdings, but the influence I want to have on the business, that is a different story.
Remember, he tried to sell that influence back to the board, and shareholders were like, hell no to the leather, because with respect, it has no value to anybody else.
Yeah, because it was drafted specifically for him.
It has an enormous amount of value to him. Look, I can empathize with that because, you know, if you spend a lot of time building a business, someone else comes in and tells you what to do, it's, you know, simultaneously extremely scary because this is my little baby that I've grown over many, many years, and now I have to give it to somebody else to run.
And we see a lot of this in the big tech.
It's very scary.
Meta, Alphabet.
Elon.
Where they don't have, where the founder keeps control, even post-listings. Mm-hmm. They don't have, I mean, I don't know how much Zuckerberg has of Meta, 10%, 20%. But at the board meeting, he's got 52% of the vote because there's those, you know.
And that's because it's his baby and he doesn't want to let go of it. And I get that.
Yeah, I do get it. But I largely dislike it because, I mean, I do think that if Mark Zuckerberg must go, then he must go. He must not. The fact that it's his baby is neither here nor there. He must be the best CEO for the position. The fact that he birthed it is irrelevant. If he's no longer the best CEO, he must, like, there's a door, Humba.
I understand both perspectives, right? And I understand both perspectives because I've kind of been in both boats, right? Where you sit and you say, it's my idea, it's my vision. I've brought it to life. And I still hold the view that if it is your vision, nobody's going to be able to execute it the way you are, right? Mm-hmm. But I understand Sai's point of view to say that there comes a point where you're too close to the situation. You need some bit of distance. And if you look at the Ackermans situation and the pick and pay situation, is Raymond Ackerman built the business. He was there. He was close to it and everything. The Ackerman family now that has inherited the business is not as close to it as perhaps Raymond might have been in his younger days. And so a willingness to step back and say, we'll give up a little bit, we'll give back a little bit.
That's like a generational thing, and I understand that context. But like, think about the restaurant owner that sells 51% of their business to Famous Brands.
Yes.
And then Famous Brands says, thank you, we're closing all your shops.
Yes.
Yeah.
How many times does that happen?
But then all of them.
Well, how does that feel now?
Because weirdly, I know three people who sold 51% to Famous Brands, and let's say they're not three happy people. But then you must bootstrap it. MailChimp. MailChimp's worth like $20 billion. How much funding have they taken?
Zero.
Who owns 100% of the business?
The founder.
Founders.
Telegram.
Exactly. I love it.
Telegram.
The founder of Telegram. Another one. Another example.
I was going to say something really nasty now.
But
the only thing people use Telegram for is crypto scams, man. Come on.
That too.
Sorry, Telegram peeps, if you see this,
it serves a purpose. But it comes back to, and you know, I got no sympathy. I mean, and as I said, I mean, I literally know people who sold 51% to Famous Brands. You know, they had a plan. It didn't work. They knew what they were getting into, right? You understand what 49% means?
And then they close your business from under your feet.
Well, in some cases, the businesses were already bankrupt.
Okay, maybe.
So, I mean, I this idea that I have control because I'm special, like, nonsense. If you're special, we'll vote for you. And you're like, when you're not special. So one day he will be very old and he's still the boss because he has shares. Or what? Do we now get his kid? I mean, is that what happens? He leaves it to his kids, Ackermans. And now we get baby Zuck. And who knows? They might not be anything.
As sparky as Big Zuck. Fair enough. That's a fair point. This is why I say I can understand kind of both sides of it.
I think you have to make the choice at some point whether or not you want your business to be bigger than you.
No, there is a Rubicon. There is definitely a Rubicon to be crossed where you get to a point and you say, I've pushed it up to this point. Beyond this point, we're going to need somebody else to get involved. We're going to need to look at things differently. And as a founder, that's the key difference between your business being bigger than you and your business collapsing.
And some have done it well. And I would name you Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. I mean, they don't have special controls. And Bill Gates, okay, he's mostly giving his money away. What's he?
Well, he's made enough of it.
Yeah. And he, you know, by the time that sort of he left in, when was it, 2000, when he stepped down as CEO and went onto the board, he owned like a handful percent, like 5 or 6.
Mm.
That's fine.
See, this is the question, is I guess, is, you know, so sort of sidetracking this conversation, is your business is growing. Do you take investments and dilute yourself or not?
So, and to me, the question is, because I've had this, as have you, we've all had businesses, and this is the question. And you've got to make, and it's a hard call, by taking investments, I dilute myself, but do I end up with a bigger slice of pie?
Yes.
But if it does the,
well,
does,
sometimes no.
But that's, no, but, and that's, but that's, the, that's,
but that's for you to
question.
Structure.
That's why it's a hard
But
question.
That's also for you to structure. It's for you to then, it's the same, it's the Rubicon conversation to say, beyond this point, am I still actively involved in the business? Do I still want to have influence in the business? Do I still want to have a meaningful say in the business? Or am I comfortable shifting into the position of a silent partner? Because at some point, that is what you become, right? Mm-hmm. So, and the Rubicon might not necessarily be exactly 50%. It might be at the point where effective control no longer sits with you, where certain decisions no longer sit with you, where a certain vision no longer sits with you. I, for one, don't believe that you need to be the CEO of a business to run the business, right? You can have a CEO, you can appoint the business, but you can still make all of the relevant decisions that pertain to that business, depending on how it's structured. But it could be beneficial because it could be beneficial towards the market, the external market. Think about Pick n Pay again.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been beneficial to have Raymond Ackerman standing there and being the CEO of the company until he passed on. It could have been beneficial to have the next generation take over and say, this is the position we are not letting go of. Or you sit back and you say, the market likes a Sean Summers as a whoever, and that's what it is. Look at Remgro. Mm. Look at Johan Rupert. Johan Rupert is not the CEO of Richemont, but he best believe he controls Richemont. Mm. Best believe no decision takes place there without him knowing about it. You know what I mean? So I think when you look at business and you look at structuring and you look at especially a business that has many other businesses or that has many other assets within it, it's important to understand where you want the business to go. It's important to understand your overall goal as to, as you said, Pietri, do you want it to be bigger than me? Do you want it to be something that I always have to have the final say in? Or are there aspects of the business where you say, I don't want to have the final say in this, this, and this, but the overall vision of the business needs to look this way.
And are you happy with owning all of a very small pie? Or are you happy with a slice of a giant pie?
Much bigger.
And the folks selling 51% to Famous Brands thought, hey, let's have a slice of a big pie.
And it doesn't always work out.
Yeah. And what they misunderstood is that Famous Brands is ruthless. You know, Famous Brands looks at numbers, doesn't work, shuts it down. Whereas, you know, I know folks who've worked in the restaurant trade who've had different brand, and they keep the non-performing. And I'm like, why? And it's like, oh, and there's like, you know, great staff and this and that. And it was my first restaurant and I met my wife there. And I'm like, but none of this is about numbers. Famous Brands is like, you have a wife, don't care. It's this thing making profit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the distinction between the mom and pop.
I guess this takes us back to that little Starbucks Chipotle thing where it's like, it just feels a bit inhuman in the end, right?
Yeah. I'm going to turn you into a socialist. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to repeat what Sai said. It's capitalism.
Yeah, and you don't have to sell your sauce.
You don't. But this is the thing. I think for me, what you're saying about the pie thing is so important because younger Jimmy was adamant about, and I'm still fairly young. I say this like I'm still fairly young, but new age entrepreneur Jimmy wants to start a business, right? Mm-hmm. Was I must own 100%. I must have control over this. I must do this. I must do this. I must do this because it's my vision. It's my baby. I mean, you can resonate with that. You founded Herenia, Just One Lap. We've all done this, right? But there comes a point where you say, the strategic benefits of bringing on a partner for the percentage of ownership that I'm losing versus what I'm gaining makes more sense. Your thing as a founder is to discern whether or not that partner intends to cannibalize your business or grow your business.
And it's a hard question.
That's where your pain point is.
Slowly morphing into like a small business podcast. So one of the things that I sort of think about is that, let's say, for example, I go and I raise $100 million for Herenia now. Right? I could spend that money in a year. Guarantee you, we'll see my brand everywhere. Like, we'll grow this business massively, right? However, the equity that I sell now, let's make it smaller numbers. Let's say I sell 50% of the business for 5 million rand, right? If the current growth rate continues, in 10 years from now, 50% of the business will be worth considerably more than 5 million. So over time, this, the half that you sell today in 10 years from now is going to be the biggest mistake you've made.
Yes, but at that point, you haven't crossed your Rubicon, right? So your Rubicon, you've just pushed out by 10 years.
Yeah.
But think about the exact same scenario, right? And say, if in 10 years' time, the... So let's say the opportunity you have now is 100 million for the same 50% and not 5 million.
Yeah, then you
how much it. Further then you, in
then
10 years?
Then it's the best decision
then it's
made.
Then it's your exit. Yeah, but partly
often,
your
but
exit.
Often you can't sell your company at 10 times what it's worth or 100 times what it's worth. It's
no,
worth
no.
what it's worth.
No, but if you take in 5 million now for half the business and in 10 years the business is now worth 500 million, that's not the worst decision you've made. That's the best decision you've made. Because there's a real chance that if you don't take the 5 million, your business in 10 years' time is
doesn't
worth...
Doesn't get to that point.
Doesn't get there, or is only worth 7 or 8. And that's the trick. I disagree that you now are aggrieved that you're only worth a quarter of a billion instead of half a billion. I think that...
You might have been only worth 100 million instead of a quarter of a billion.
And that's the hard question, is that when someone comes to you with 5 million, if you got 5 million, I got a business to sell. When someone comes to you with that 5 million, that's the question. Do you take the 5 million and it's a disaster and it fails? Do you take the 5 million and it grows to 500 million? Do you not take the 5 million and it grows to 500? Or, you know, it's all of those different quadrants.
If you have a situation where you have a trajectory and you think to yourself, like, in 5 years from now, I won't need this 5 million.
Well, then, but that's the decision you have to make.
That's the point I'm trying to make. It's like, it's really hard. So now you sell, it's like the most expensive thing you've ever sold.
But as an entrepreneur, that's always the entrepreneurial conversation, right?
But if you think about
your situation like that, right? God forbid this, hope this doesn't happen to anyone. If you make that decision and you say, no, I'm going to continue bootstrapping, continue going for the next 5 years or for the next 10 years, and the very next day you have a heart attack and you can't, that's a completely different conversation. So you make the decision for the here and now. And to bring it back to what we were talking about from a company valuation perspective, think about someone like Telkom. You've got a share price that's sitting at 20 Rand. It's come down from that MTN offer that got you up to 55 Rand. No one is interested. You've got a 7 billion Rand asset, or just shy of 7 billion Rand in SwiftNet. The decision to unbundle, the decision to get rid of part of your baby needs to happen. You can keep the infrastructure business, but how much does it cost you to maintain? Is it worth it? Or do you take 7 billion Rand right now? Right? But I suppose this leads to a very important conversation, which we will have to have another time. And that is around valuations, right? If we're saying 5 million for 50%, at what valuation is that? How do we determine valuations? And what is a fair valuation that kind of bridges the gap between capitalism and socialism, and everybody's socialism
and usually the person with the checkbook has the power.
Usually the person with the checkbook has the power. That's the deep dive for this week.